Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we like to really get our hands dirty with history. You know what I mean? Like, today we're going all the way back to 1910.
Oh, wow.
To the very first issue of the Crisis magazine. Now, you might be thinking, okay, 1910, that's a long time ago. What does that have to do with me here in, you know, Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, 2025?
Right.
But because this, the issues that they were wrestling with back then, voting rights, education, housing, economic opportunity. Still pretty relevant, huh?
It's remarkable, isn't it? This magazine edited by W.E.B. Du Bois, it was really a platform for African Americans at a time when their voices were often, you know, silenced or marginalized.
Right.
And it's amazing to see how many of their hopes and concerns from back then are still things we're grappling with today right here in Southeast Houston.
Yeah, and you know, they state their purpose right up front in this very first issue. To set forth those facts and arguments which show the danger of race prejudice. And sadly, that's a purpose that's still relevant more than a century later. So let's jump right in. They have this new section called Along the Color Line.
Okay.
And one of the first things that jumped out at me was this story about Arkansas. They adopted a grandfather clause in their state constitution.
Right.
And I was like, what?
This clause was a blatant attempt to disenfranchise black voters. You see, it said you could only vote if your grandfather had been eligible to vote before 1866.
Wow.
Which, of course, effectively excluded most black citizens because, well, their grandfathers had been enslaved.
Right.
It's a fascinating example of how seemingly neutral legal language can be used to achieve a very discriminatory outcome. And sadly, we see echoes of this pattern even today.
It's like, it's not really history repeating, but more like the same old tricks just wearing a new disguise.
Exactly. It's crucial to be able to recognize these patterns so that we can effectively challenge them, whether it's advocating for fair voting laws or pushing back against discriminatory practices in housing or education.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, speaking of things that seem positive on the surface but have a darker side, there's this article about J.C. Napier, a black man being appointed as Register of the U.S. Treasury. Sounds like progress, right?
On the surface, yes. But if you read between the lines, the article suggests that Napier's appointment was more about political maneuvering than a genuine commitment to equality.
Oh, really?
It hints that he was chosen to appease black voters after a particular Republican candidate failed to get their support.
So kind of like tokenism.
Sadly, yes. Tokenism is a tactic as old as time itself.
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a much bigger problem.
Precisely. It creates the illusion of progress without actually addressing the underlying issues.
Okay, this next story, this one really hit me hard. Baltimore was actually trying to legally segregate housing, like dividing streets by race. Can you believe that?
It is shocking. This proposed ordinance aimed to designate specific streets as either white or black, preventing people from living on a street where the majority of residents were of a different race.
That's just unbelievable. It's like something out of a dystopian novel.
It is. It's a stark reminder that even though such blatant segregation might seem like a relic of the past, its legacy still affects us today. We see it in the disparities in housing access and affordability that persist in many communities, even right here in Southeast Houston.
Yeah, it makes you realize that history isn't just something that happened in the past.
Right.
It's still shaping our present. And it's up to us to understand those forces so we can, you know, work towards a better future for everyone.
Absolutely.
And then there's this article about a push for a colored regiment in the New York National Guard. Now, on the surface, that sounds, I don't know, maybe positive. But knowing what happened later in Brownsville,
right,
it makes you wonder.
It does raise questions about the true motivations behind it. Was this genuine support for black participation in the military? Or was it more about creating a separate and unequal force? This seemingly positive development becomes even more troubling when you consider the events of the Brownsville incident, which we'll discuss in more detail later.
Definitely adds another layer to the story. And then there's this whole theme of education that runs throughout the magazine. You see articles celebrating new schools for black children. But then right alongside those are reports of the huge inequalities they faced.
It highlights this important distinction between access and equity.
Okay.
You see, just because schools were being built didn't mean that black students were receiving the same quality of education as their white counterparts.
Right.
Black schools were consistently underfunded. They had fewer qualified teachers. They lacked essential materials. It's a pattern that, unfortunately, we still see in many places today.
Yeah, that reminds me of all the work that's being done right now in our local school districts to try to address these disparities. The fight for equitable school funding. It's a battle that's still going on.
Absolutely. And it shows how important it is for us to be involved in our communities, to make our voices heard on these issues that directly impact our children and our future.
And there's this one story from Atlanta that really stuck with me.
Oh, yeah.
It's about this black preacher who was advocating for better schools. and he pointed out that black families were paying taxes for an education that white children were getting for free. And I was like, wait a minute, does that sound familiar to anyone? This is an issue that we're still grappling with today.
It is the fight for equitable education funding. It's far from over. We need to be aware of these disparities and advocate for policies that ensure that all children have access to a quality education.
Absolutely. And then there's this other story about a school fight in Chicago where white boys were trying to force out black pupils. It's heartbreaking to see how these things repeat themselves.
It is. It shows that education alone can't solve deep-seated societal problems. We need to address those underlying issues of prejudice and discrimination if we want to create truly inclusive and equitable learning environments for all children. But you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There are some really inspiring stories in this magazine, too.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Well, there are a number of articles about black entrepreneurship thriving. You know, alongside those stories of struggle, you see these glimmers of hope and progress.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, there's a piece about this successful shoe store chain in the South, and another one about a New York real estate agent who was specifically serving black tenants, you know, finding them homes and helping them navigate the housing market.
I love that. That's so cool. It's like, even in the face of all this oppression, they're still finding ways to succeed.
Exactly. This was the era of Booker T. Washington's message of self-reliance.
Right.
And you really see that reflected in these articles. It's this idea that even in the face of adversity, you can create your own opportunities. You can build something for yourself and your community.
It's a powerful message. And it's so relevant today, too, you know, especially here in Southeast Houston. We have such a vibrant and diverse entrepreneurial community.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't all easy for them, right? I mean, I saw some articles about some pretty blatant discrimination that was trying to hold them back.
Oh, yeah. For every step forward, it seemed like there were forces trying to pull them back down.
Ugh, that's so frustrating.
It is. There's this one article about the Barbers Board in Missouri. They were allegedly blocking black barber schools from getting licensed.
What? What?
It's not entirely clear, but it seems like they were just trying to limit competition to protect the white-owned barbershops.
That's messed up.
It is. And then there's this other story from New Orleans where labor unions were actually defending black workers.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, because they were being accused of laziness simply because they were being paid better wages.
Right. That makes no sense.
It doesn't, but it shows you the kind of absurd logic that was used to justify discrimination back then.
So they were being punished for earning a decent wage.
Essentially, it was this fear of black economic advancement that, sadly, we still see in some forms today. You know, this idea that somehow if black people are doing well, it's a threat to white people.
It's like this constant push and pull between progress and prejudice. It's exhausting.
It is, and it reminds us that the fight for equality is a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, it's about constantly pushing forward, even when things get tough, even when it feels like you're taking one step forward and two steps back.
Exactly. Speaking of marathons, there's one event that's covered in the magazine that we really need to unpack.
What's that?
The Brownsville incident.
Oh, yeah. That was a really dark chapter in American history.
It was essentially black soldiers were accused of shooting up a town in Texas.
Right.
And they were dishonorably discharged without a trial, even though there was no real evidence against them.
It was a complete miscarriage of justice.
It was. And what makes it even more egregious is the historical context. Just 2 years earlier, you had the Athens incident, where white soldiers actually did commit violence.
Right.
They even killed a militiaman, and yet they received minimal punishment.
It's sickening to think about the double standard.
It is. And the crisis explicitly draws this parallel, you know, highlighting the blatant injustice of how these two cases were handled.
And the impact on those soldiers, on their families, on the black community as a whole, it must have been devastating.
Absolutely. The Brownsville incident cast a long shadow. You know, it really reinforced this feeling that even in uniform, even when they were putting their lives on the line for their country, black Americans were not treated as equal citizens. They were not given the same rights, the same protections, the same presumption of innocence.
It's heartbreaking. And it's a stark reminder that the fight for equality, it extends to every corner of American life.
It does. And that brings us to two individual stories that, while they're incredibly difficult to hear, are essential to understanding the realities of the Jim Crow South.
Okay.
The magazine recounts the cases of Pink Franklin and Steve Green, two men whose lives were tragically impacted by the pervasive racism of the time.
And these stories really, really personalize the issue in a way that statistics or legal arguments just can't, you know. They put a human face on the horrors of Jim Crow.
They do. So Pin Franklin, he was accused of breaking a labor contract in South Carolina.
Right. And these contracts, they were often used to trap black workers in exploitative conditions.
Exactly. So this constable, he breaks into Franklin's house in the middle of the night and starts shooting at him.
Oh my God.
Franklin, not knowing who's shooting, he fires back in self-defense and he kills the constable.
Oh wow.
And for that, he was sentenced to death.
That's just unbelievable.
It is. And then you have Steve Green, who was threatened by his former landlord if he didn't continue working for him, so he moves away. But when he hires himself out to a neighbor, the landlord finds him and shoots him multiple times.
Oh my God.
He manages to escape, but he's hunted by posses and bloodhounds.
It's like something out of a nightmare.
It is. These stories, they're not just anecdotes. They represent the lived reality for so many Black Americans in the Jim Crow South.
Right, where even the smallest perceived offense could be met with brutal violence.
Exactly, and a complete disregard for their basic human rights.
It's a lot to take in, but it's important that we don't shy away from these stories. You know, that we confront the ugliness of the past so that we can learn from it and work towards a better future.
I agree. And you know, it's not all doom and gloom in this magazine. There's also a section of opinions and editorials, which provides a really fascinating glimpse into the diverse voices and perspectives of the time.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not just straight news reporting.
No, it's more than that. It's about sparking debate, challenging readers to think critically about the issues at hand.
I like that. So what kind of opinions are we talking about here?
Well, there's a quote from Cardinal Logue that basically says that Black people should have been educated before emancipation.
Wow. Talk about adding insult to injury.
It is. It's a deeply condescending viewpoint that reflects a common belief at the time. This idea that Black people were somehow incapable of self-governance or intellectual development without the guidance of white society.
Oh, it's amazing how deeply ingrained these racist ideas were.
It is, and it reminds us that even within institutions like the church, you know, racism was often deeply entrenched.
Yeah, makes you wonder how much has really changed, doesn't it?
It does. Then you have the New York Sun mocking the optimism of the Negro Business League, implying that Black people have short memories for celebrating their achievements in the face of ongoing discrimination.
Oof. That's so dismissive.
It is. It's minimizing the real progress being made while simultaneously ignoring the systemic barriers that were still in place.
Right. It's like they're saying, oh, you should just be grateful for what you have. Don't ask for more.
Exactly. But amidst all this negativity, there's also a glimmer of hope. The magazine includes an anecdote about Mark Twain secretly paying for a Black student's education at Yale.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Which the author describes as a form of reparation.
That's pretty amazing, especially for that time period.
It is. It's a powerful example of an individual recognizing the injustices of the past and taking concrete action to address them.
It's inspiring to see that even back then there were people who were actively working to create a more just and equitable society.
Absolutely. And all these diverse voices, they remind us that history is never simple.
Right. It's not just black and white.
Exactly. It's a complex tapestry of perspectives and ideologies and actions, both positive and negative. And it's our job to sift through these complexities, to learn from them, and to use that knowledge to inform our present and shape our future.
And speaking of shaping the future, that brings us to the heart of the Crisis, W.B. Du Bois' own editorial.
Right. This is where we really see his vision for the magazine and his unwavering commitment to equality.
And his words are just as powerful today as they were over a century ago.
They are. He speaks with such passion and conviction about the need for agitation, for raising awareness of injustice and demanding change.
And he uses this brilliant analogy of a toothache.
Oh, yeah.
He says it's not a good thing, but it serves a purpose. It alerts you to a problem that needs to be addressed.
Right. So he's basically saying that complacency is the enemy of progress.
Exactly. And that sometimes you need to be a little uncomfortable, a little disruptive to make people pay attention to the issues that matter.
It's a call to action that really resonates, especially in today's world where there's so much information coming at us all the time.
Right. It's easy to become numb to it all.
It is. We can't afford to become desensitized to injustice. We need to stay engaged. We need to stay informed. And we need to be willing to raise our voices.
And Du Bois, he also emphasizes the importance of Black voters being independent, voting based on issues, and not blind loyalty to a particular party.
Mm-hmm.
That's a message that's just as relevant today as it was back then. You know, we need to be critical thinkers. We need to be engaged citizens, and we need to hold our elected officials accountable.
Absolutely. He understood that true progress requires more than just voting rights. It demands a fundamental shift in power dynamics, a dismantling of systemic racism, and a commitment to creating a society where everyone has an equal opportunity to thrive.
And that's a vision that we're still striving for today.
We are. His editorial is a powerful reminder that the fight for equality is an ongoing process. It's a relay race where each generation picks up the baton and carries it forward.
And this deep dive into the crisis, it's been a powerful way to connect with that legacy, to understand the struggles and triumphs of those who came before us, and to find inspiration for the work that still needs to be done.
It has. It's been a journey through history, but it's also a call to action for the present.
It's like he's speaking directly to us, you know, across time.
I know what you mean.
I wonder what he would say about race relations today here in 2025. What would he think of the progress we've made, the challenges we still face right here in our own community in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena?
That's a tough question. I think he would be both encouraged by how far we've come and disheartened by how much work still needs to be done.
Yeah, I think you're right. He might even say something like, "The fight for justice is a long and winding road, but it's a road we must continue to travel together."
I can hear him saying that.
Right. He'd probably tell us to stay engaged, to never take our hard-won rights for granted, to remember that the struggle for equality, it's not a spectator sport, you know. It requires active participation from each and every one of us.
Absolutely. It's not enough to just sit on the sidelines and hope for the best. We have to be willing to get in the game, to get our hands dirty, to do the work.
Exactly. And I think he would be really excited to see the work that organizations like Think and Act Locally are doing right here in Southeast Houston.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, we're all about empowering residents to make a difference in their own communities, to tackle issues like education inequity, affordable housing access, to economic opportunities.
It's about giving people the tools and the resources they need to create positive change at the local level.
Right. And I think Dubois would see the clear parallels between his work with the crisis and our mission here at Think and Act Locally. It's about raising awareness, sparking dialogue, inspiring action.
And it all starts right here at home, you know, not in some far off capital or ivory tower, but in the everyday actions we take to build a more just and equitable society right here in our own neighborhoods.
This deep dive into the crisis, it's been more than just a history lesson for me. It's been a call to action.
Me too. It's a reminder that we're all part of this ongoing story, this struggle for justice and equality that's been going on for generations.
And that our actions, no matter how small they may seem, can contribute to a larger movement for positive change.
Absolutely. Every little bit counts. Every voice matters.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with this question. What can we do individually and collectively to create a community that reflects the values of justice, equality, opportunity for all? What steps can we take to ensure that the stories of the future are filled with progress and hope, and the realization of the dreams that Dubois and so many others fought so tirelessly for?
Those are powerful questions, and I think the answers lie within each and every one of us.
If you're feeling inspired to make a difference, to get involved in your local community, be sure to check out Think and Act Locally. You can find us online at thinkandactlocally.com. And if you believe in our mission and want to support our work, we welcome donations at thinkanddactlocally.com/donate. Every little bit helps.
Thanks for joining us on this journey through time and ideas. It's been a pleasure.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.